Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello, and welcome to As It Is, a free, daily, 30-minute program designed to help you learn everyday American English. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz at the Voice of America's Learning English branch in Washington. Today on the program, we take you to the Western United States. There is a restaurant in the state of Colorado in the town of Rifle that lets its customers carry loaded weapons while they eat. Restaurant workers also carry loaded guns.
I feel as safe as can be. This is the safest place you can be right now. So no, it doesn't intimidate you.
Then you will hear Jonathan Evans' technology report. This week, Jonathan tells us how activists are using technology to help news reporters and democracy activists protect their privacy from government spies.
But the same system that helps protect human rights activists can be used by hackers, criminals, or terrorists to hide their identity and activities online.
And as always, we will present the making of a nation. Every day here at VOA Learning English, we bring you news from and about America and the world. And we tell you the often surprising and always interesting history of the United States. We're on the radio, on the web, and we come to you on a podcast. We are wherever you are. We're the Voice of America. People from around the world visit Rifle, a small town in the American state of Colorado. Many of the visitors stop at a restaurant called Shooter's Grill. They go there for the food and for the waitresses. These women openly carry loaded guns when they bring customers their meals. Customers are also welcome to bring loaded firearms into the eatery. VOA recently visited Shooter's Grill. We heard a mix of opinions about this most unusual business. It is late morning on a Monday. Yet at this hour, people are already lining up to eat at Shooter's Grill. Where else can you find a sign saying guns are welcome on premises? Georgina Booth is a waitress at Shooter's Grill. She strongly supports the restaurant's open carry policy.
I feel like it's not a problem at all. I mean, it's holstered all the time, and hopefully the need never arises to have to take it out.
Lauren Bobert owns Shooter's Grill. She says her restaurant stands for three ideas.
God, guns, and great food.
She and her husband, Jason, opened the eatery in 2013. They named it Shooter's Grill because it is in Rifle, a town named for a gun. Ms. Bobert was asked why guns are permitted in her restaurant.
One reason why I began to carry was there was an altercation in the alley where a man was beat to death, and it kind of alarmed me, and I wanted a way to protect myself and to protect my employees and to protect my customers.
Rifle is on the Colorado River. Many people in the town go hunting and spend a lot of time outdoors. Ms. Bobert says her business's gun policy is right because of the tradition and respect for firearms in this part of the United States. She says that if two people each have a gun, they have something to talk about. And she says talking about guns lets her learn more about her customers as people. Chris Hoskins has come to eat at Shooter's Grill. She says she likes the restaurant's policy, but she says she didn't realize people could carry weapons there until she saw news reports about it.
Well, oddly enough, I probably didn't even notice until it became a story, and then I noticed.
D.K. Brakel is visiting Shooter's Grill for the first time. He likes having loaded weapons around him.
I feel as safe as can be. This is the safest place you can be right now, so I know it doesn't intimidate you.
People from other countries visit the restaurant. Peter Wirth is from Germany. He said he came to see the weapons and the women who carry them.
So we stop here because we are a little bit hungry, and a guy on the street say, this grill is famous for the beautiful ladies, and all ladies wearing guns.
The food served at Shooter's Grill has names that relate to firearms. They include shotgun burrito and locked and loaded nachos. The subject of guns is an emotional one in the United States. Many Americans say there are too many guns in the country. Others say they are permitted under the U.S. Constitution to own weapons, and they will not stop doing so. Of the 50 states, 30 let people carry weapons openly, without permission from the government. Colorado is one of the 30. John Dyer is the chief of police in Rifle.
Well, what an open carry means is that people are allowed to carry guns in the open, like for instance that I'm carrying on the side here, that would be considered open carry, versus a concealed carry where I'm hiding the weapon.
Some Shooter's Grill customers are not happy with the restaurant's open carry policy. Tom Fair is from Cleveland, Ohio. A friend invited him for a meal.
I'm not a fan of guns. I'm uncomfortable with the fact that our country is as parts of our country are as fascinated with guns as they are.
Others in Rifle agree with Mr. Fair. They think guns should not be permitted in a restaurant. They think letting waitresses and customers carry loaded weapons is just a way for Shooter's Grill to advertise the business. Now, our weekly look at the latest technology news. Chris Doten knows how dangerous conditions can be for democracy activists and journalists working under hostile governments. He is the head of digital technology programs at the National Democratic Institute, a non-governmental organization that supports openness in government. Our technology correspondent Jonathan Evans is here now to tell us how Mr. Doten helps news reporters and democracy activists protect their privacy from government spying while they are online.
We do work in relatively closed societies, Mr. Doten said. There are a lot of dangers, and we always try to take a thoughtful look at the risks that we're incurring for the people we're working with. Those risks often include government raids, computer seizure, theft of private data, and the identification of supporters and private email communications. These invasions can lead to arrest, expulsion from a country, or worse. But Chris Doten said there's a technological solution that is helping people around the world protect their online activities. It is called the Amnesic Incognito Live System, or TAILS. In computer terms, a live system is a standalone operating system that runs directly off a DVD or, increasingly, a USB memory stick. A live system uses only a computer's RAM. None of the operating files are saved anywhere. Once downloaded to a portable disk drive or USB, users simply connect TAILS to any computer and run it. When taken out of the computer, the live system leaves no evidence of ever being used on the computer. Chris Doten says TAILS comes with additional security applications that users can easily access. There's also a multi-protocol chat client that can speak to Facebook, Google Chat, and others called Pigeon, he added. A growing number of journalists and rights groups are using TAILS. The nonprofit group Reporters Without Borders works in support of freedom of the press. It has suggested TAILS for journalists who need to protect their sources. Activists in Tibet use TAILS to securely document human rights abuses there by the Chinese government. And groups working to fight violence within families are now using TAILS to report abuse and protect victims' identities. But the same system that helps protect human rights activists can be used by hackers, criminals, or terrorists to hide their identity and activities online. Mr. Doten said the real concern should be how often internet activists, journalists, and others are targeted online and then punished for their activities. I'm frankly shocked at the state of digital security among U.S. journalists, he said. People who have real dangers that they've seen externally and internally at times. The fact that newsrooms around the country, even the big ones, are not investing more in this, I think, is a real crime. I'm Jonathan Evans.
Thanks, Jonathan. And that's our program for today. We hope it has informed and entertained you and has helped you learn everyday American English. We want to hear what interests you, so write to us. Our email address is learningenglish@voanews.com. That's learningenglish@voanews.com. And please know that we read every message you send us. The Making of a Nation is coming up next. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz, reporting from the VOA Learning English headquarters in Washington. We'll be back tomorrow at this same time to help you learn everyday American English with another broadcast, webcast, and podcast edition of As It Is from the Voice of America.
from VOA Learning English. Welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. Today we continue our story of the United States Constitution. In the summer of 1787, a group of delegates gathered for a convention in Philadelphia. Their plan was to rewrite the Articles of Confederation. Those articles created a weak union of the 13 states. Instead of rewriting the articles, however, they spent that summer writing a completely new plan of government. On September 17th, after 4 months of often bitter debate, the delegates finally agreed to the new plan. Now they had to get at least 9 of the 13 states to approve it. Delegates to the Philadelphia Convention had met in secret. They wanted to be able to debate proposals and change their minds without worrying about public reaction. Now they were free to speak openly. Each had a copy of the new Constitution. Newspapers also had copies. They published every word. Public reaction was great indeed. Arguments for and against were the same as those voiced by delegates to the convention. The Constitution would save the United States. The Constitution would create a dictator. Yale Law School professor Akhil Reed Amar says the public debate about the Constitution was one of its first successes as a democratic document. He notes that even democracies of long ago, like those in Greece or Italy, did not let citizens vote on their constitutions.
People could be for the Constitution or against it. No one was shut down. No one was put in prison. If they liked George Washington or they didn't like George Washington, just this proliferation, robust, wide open, uninhibited discourse up and down a continent.
Supporters of the new Constitution understood that to win ratification, they needed to speak out. So a few weeks after the document was signed, they began writing statements in support of the proposed Constitution. Their statements appeared first in newspapers in New York. They were called the Federalist Papers. They were published under the name of Publius, but they were really written by three men, Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, and John Jay. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas says he deeply respects the men who wrote the Federalist Papers.
These are people who were engaged, who knew the Constitution. Also want you to know, these were not scholars. These were farmers. These were business people. Some of them who had formal education, some who did not. But they cared about this country.
Years later, historians said the Federalist Papers were the greatest explanation of the Constitution ever written. But in 1787, they had little effect on public opinion. The debate over the Constitution divided Americans into two groups. Those who supported it were known as Federalists. Those who opposed it were known as Anti-Federalists. The Anti-Federalists were not anti-American. They were governors, heroes of the Revolutionary War, and even a future president. Yet they distrusted the idea of a strong central government. Give too much power to the president, Congress, and the courts, they said, and citizens would no longer be free. They would lose the liberties gained in the war for independence from Britain. Law professor Akhil Reed Amar says the Anti-Federalists were an important part of the debate and of history.
The people who oppose the Constitution, who think it could be better still, they're not cast out. They become presidents of the United States, vice presidents of the United States, justices on the Supreme Court. It's extraordinary how they're kept in the process.
There were both Federalists and Anti-Federalists in the Continental Congress. The Congress had few powers, but it was the only central government the 13 states had at that time. It met in New York City. The convention in Philadelphia had sent the Continental Congress a copy of the new Constitution. Within 8 days, the Congress agreed that each state should organize a convention to discuss ratification. One by one, the states held those meetings. Delaware was the first state to ratify early in December 1787. All the delegates voted to approve it. Pennsylvania was the next to ratify, also in December. New Jersey ratified the Constitution in December, followed by Georgia and Connecticut in January. That made 5 states. The Federalists needed just 4 more to win ratification. Massachusetts voted in early February. Delegates to the state convention wanted the Constitution amended to include guarantees to protect citizens' rights. They agreed to ratify if these guarantees were added later. Maryland ratified the Constitution at the end of April. There, a number of delegates included a letter of protest with their vote. They said, if the plan of government were not amended, the liberty and happiness of the people would be threatened. At the end of May, South Carolina became the 8th state to ratify. Just 1 more state, and the new Constitution would become the law of the land. All eyes turned to Virginia. Virginia was the biggest of the 13 states. 1/5 of all the people in America lived in Virginia. The men who attended the ratifying convention were among the most famous names in the nation: James Madison, Patrick Henry, George Mason, James Monroe, Edmund Randolph, and John Marshall. The most famous Virginian, George Washington, stayed at his home, Mount Vernon. All during the month of June, however, riders brought him messages from the convention and carried messages back. Thomas Jefferson was still in Paris serving as America's representative to France, but others kept him informed of everything that happened at home. Jefferson wrote back that he liked most of the Constitution, but he said, I do not like the fact that it does not contain a declaration of the rights of citizens. For 3 weeks, the Virginia delegates argued about the Constitution. By the end of June, they were ready to vote. Patrick Henry, the outspoken anti-federalist, asked to make a final statement. If this convention approves the Constitution, Henry said, I will feel that I fought for good reasons and lost the fight. If this happens, I will wait and hope. I will hope that the spirit of the American Revolution is not lost. I will hope that this new plan of government is changed to protect the safety, the liberty, and the happiness of the American people. Then the convention voted. Virginia approved the Constitution. However, like Massachusetts, It added that the document must include a Declaration of Rights for the nation's people. Federalists in Virginia thought their state was the ninth to ratify, the one that made the Constitution the law of the land. But they soon learned that New Hampshire had ratified a few days earlier. Virginia was number 10. That left three states, North Carolina, Rhode Island, and New York. In a way, New York was the most important of all. If New York refused to join the Union under the Constitution, it would be almost impossible for a central government to rule the nation. The 12 other states would be divided in two, geographically separated by New York State. Alexander Hamilton was a leader of the Federalists. They used their right to filibuster to make many long speeches to delay the vote. They wanted to wait to hear what Virginia would do. Early in July, they got the news. But New York's anti-Federalists kept up the fight for three more weeks. It was not until the end of July that New York finally ratified the Constitution. The vote was extremely close, 30-27. Like Massachusetts and Virginia, New York demanded a Declaration of Rights. The long struggle to give the United States a strong central government was over. It took 4 months to write a new constitution. It took 10 months to ratify it. Yale Law School professor Akhil Reed Amar says adopting the Constitution was, in his words, the most democratic deed in history.
For the first time ever in the history of the planet, an entire continent got to vote on how they and their posterity would be governed. And there were lots of exclusions, you know, from our perspective, but we wouldn't exist, you know, as a democratic country, as a democratic world, but for that.
The Continental Congress declared that the Constitution would become effective the first Wednesday in March, 1789. The last two states, North Carolina and Rhode Island, did not approve it until many months after that date. Benjamin Rush of Pennsylvania, who had signed the Declaration of Independence, wrote down 8 words when he heard that the Constitution had been ratified. "It is done," he said. "We have become a nation." But before that, the nation's founders had one more question to answer. How would the Constitution guarantee citizens' rights? Delegates at the convention had raised the point many times, and several states made protecting citizens' rights a condition for approving the document. I'm Steve Embert.